You're listening to the new security broadcast from the Wilson Center's Environmental Change and Security Program. I'm Amanda King, and in this episode, ECSP Senior Fellow Sherry Goodman joins me in a conversation with Josh Busby, Associate Professor at the LBJ School of Public Affairs at the University of Texas at Austin, to discuss his latest book, States in Nature, The Effects of Climate Change on Security. For nearly two decades, Josh has produced cutting-edge research on climate change's connection to conflict and political instability. This last year, he brought that expertise to the Department of Defense, where he served as a senior advisor for climate. In our conversation, he shares insights from his book and reflects on how his experience at DOD sharpened his skills in academia.
Well, Josh, thank you for joining us today. You've been a longtime friend of the program and a go-to resource for interesting research on climate security. It's great to have you share your insights on your new book and what you've been up to lately. And I'm honored to have Sherry Goodman, a senior fellow with ECSP, join me in speaking with you today. You both have a long and winding trajectory in the field of climate security and are both experts whose work and research have been important for setting the foundation for what we know as the field today. So as an up-and-coming professional in the field of climate security, it's really a privilege to get to do this with you both. So I wanted to start by asking how you've seen the field of climate security change to what it's become today.
Thanks so much for having us on. It's a delight to be here. When I started in this field, it was almost by accident. Jeff DeBelko, who used to be at the Wilson Center, asked me and Nigel Purvis, who's a former State Department diplomat, to write a short paper for the UN around 2004 on what climate change might mean for security for the UN system. And little did I know that that would ultimately lead me to write this book and spend almost 20 years in this field. So when it first started, there wasn't really any academic literature. There wasn't any policy literature. Sherry was one of the first to come out with a major policy report in 2007 with her work at CNA. The academic literature was scant and sort of built on an earlier tradition on environmental security, but focused on climate security. So the first years were really an effort by scholars who are taking advantage of new quantitative data sets to try to nail down like the causal connections. Does climate change lead to conflict? And over the years, we've seen an effort to broaden the scope. So it's not only about does climate change lead to civil wars, but then we're starting to think about does climate change lead to social conflict like protests, riots, and strikes. But then also to think about, what are the indirect pathways? Maybe it doesn't directly lead to conflict. Maybe it under only certain conditions and certain pathways through migration or effects on agriculture. And then, more broadly to kind of get away from just thinking about conflict as the sole outcome of interest to start thinking about other kinds of negative security outcomes like humanitarian emergencies. And so now we're, alongside that, we actually have an emergent practice of climate security. And so we also start to have to think about how does the practice itself affect, security outcomes. And so I think now we're kind of in a moment of thinking about environmental peace building, but also maladaptation and ways in which, human responses to climate change can be as, if not more consequential than the physical effects of climate change itself. And so that's what I've seen over the last 20 years of maturation of the discipline, but we also have a lot of people trying to do stuff in the world and figure out what works and what doesn't.
That's great. Well, and so your new book, States in Nature, The Effects of Climate Change on Security, you argue it's a combination of state capacity, political exclusion, and international assistance that explains why climate change leads to especially bad security outcomes in some places, but not others. And you already shared a few details of the book and how you got to write the book. And thank you again for giving us that overview of how complex it is to really understand these correlations. But could you tell us a bit more about the book, why you wanted to write it, What was that motivation and some of the most interesting things that may have come from it?
Sure. When I started the book in 2013, I hadn't seen a similar book like this that from an academic standpoint. One came along pretty early in the policy space that Kurt Campbell and colleagues did through CNAS, but there hadn't, and CSIS, but I hadn't seen an academic book, although I think some have come out along the way. Mm-hmm. And, you know, that literature that I talked about on the, you know, causal connections, a lot of it makes for good articles, but doesn't make for, you know, like a book with lots of regression tables just might not be as accessible read. So I wanted to write a book of paired cases of thinking about countries that had similar exposure to climate hazards, but in some cases you had bad outcomes and in other cases you didn't. And if you could get paired cases, you know, why did Somalia have a famine after drought, but neighboring Ethiopia didn't? Or why did Syria have a civil war after a drought, but neighboring Lebanon didn't? You know, that could make for a good read and also make a contribution to the literature. And so that really motivated me to want to write a book, which just took a long time to ultimately finish it.
Yeah, well, and when I was in grad school, actually, it was very much like the Homer Dixon and those really, this means this and this. So I think I would have appreciated knowing this kind of book was out there during that time when I was also starting to understand what the link is between climate and conflict and now peace building and looking more into that. So is there anything you may have wanted to do differently with the book or different case studies or anything like that? Now reflecting that it's been out and published?
Yeah, well, one of the, so there are two substantive areas that I think would be interesting would be an application of the argument to Central America the situations in the Americas that have led to large scale out-migration. I've been collaborating with Stephanie Lutert here at the University of Texas, who has terrific data on this, and Andrew Linke and other colleagues on a paper that not quite an extension of this argument, but is related to it, because I do think similar dynamics are at play in the Americas that I just didn't have space to explore in the book. Another is, you know, that what looms large a lot in these discussions about climate security is violence between sedentary farmers and pastoralists, both in the Sahel, but extending even across to the Horn of Africa, and trying to think about the extent to which this argument can travel to those sets of cases. I would love to have done that, and maybe can in future work.
Yeah.
I think one limitation of this project is that I didn't get to do a lot of field work in these country contexts. I had a young son at home when I was beginning the project, and I'm probably less well suited to, you know, do some of the trailblazing work in dangerous places that I know, like there's some journalists who are intrepid and are able to make those kinds of trips. I would have liked to have done that. I just wasn't in a space in my life where that was going to be as easy as it might have been earlier.
Yeah, and did COVID end up putting any dents in your work too in that travel?
Well,
connecting with people.
You know, on some level, it made it more challenging because of the limitations of childcare to actually finish the book. And I was fortunate in the midst of the pandemic to have the help of a very fine caregiver who provided some excellent space for our family to, you know, be able to carry out our professional lives, both as, you know, professors, but also to finish the book. And so were it not for that, I would still be toiling on this now.
Well, it's interesting you bring up Central America. And so at the Wilson Center, Sherry and I and our ECSP team, Lauren Reese, who directs ECSP, and then our partner at NOAA, Roger Polwarty, we have an ongoing project, Improving Predictive Capabilities for the Security Risks Caused by a Changing Climate. And this past year, we've done four workshops looking at those different kind of violence, migration, just what are the linkages? And it goes off of a framework we've made in Central America, and that outmigration is a really interesting case. So I would be interested to hear too, if you are able to do more. And once we have our outcomes as well, we'll have to share with you. We're working on a brief, so that will hopefully be ready this fall. So we'll definitely share that with you. And you participated maybe in one as well.
That's right. Yeah, I'd be happy to.
Well, and so you just did a stint at the Department of Defense, serving as a senior advisor for climate. So wanted to hear, if you're able to reflect on your time and the key takeaways from your experience.
Sure. So I should note that this doesn't reflect the official views of the U.S. government, just speaking in capacity as a scholar. I've learned a lot from my experience in government. And I think one of the most important takeaways is that, when you're in academia, you don't really have an appreciation for the levers and tools that governments have and don't have to be able to try to shape and influence outcomes. And you also don't necessarily have much visibility on the sort of inside pulling and hauling between different, there are competing interests, there's limited resources, people have a lot of, time demands and different understandings of the material. And so, what scholars can bring is some expertise on their understanding of the literature, on the connections between cause and effect. But they don't really know about programs with acronyms and budgets or how to translate those good ideas into maybe programs. And so I think that's the probably most important thing that I learned that I also hope I can communicate to students is, if you want to be a change agent to make the world better, you have to invest some time in understanding what those instruments and levers are for whatever the, whether it's the U.S. government or the UN system or some other government or an NGO, that you have certain things that you can and can't do, and there are lots of limitations. And so trying to learn about that it's a hard thing for academics to be able to teach you. You almost have to kind of learn by doing. And you can be a quick study. It's almost like detective work on some level of like, who are the right people and what are the right, who knows what, and how do I learn about this in an immersive way as quickly as possible, and just be open to having conversations with people who've been there and done it, and you need to kind of have guides inside the government who can sort of open your eyes to demystify processes and acronyms that otherwise might not mean anything to you. So I don't know, that's what I've kind of take away from that experience, and hope to inform my teaching sensibilities going forward.
Yeah. Sherry, did you have any follow-up questions?
Well, thank you, Amanda. And it's great to be here with you both. Thinking back, Josh began his scholarship in this area, well, really a little bit after my first tour at the Department of Defense, in what I would call the first chapter of environmental security in the 1990s, when the first connections were being established between global environmental change and security, and the military in particular and other security agencies were really understanding what it meant to adopt an approach of environmental security, both getting your own house in order and then working with militaries around the world to set a positive example in terms of constructive military to military environmental engagement. First, in the wake of the post-Cold War era, in sort of cleaning up the legacy of industrial contamination in the US, but in the former Soviet Union, former Soviet states, as I say, my own career went from weapons to waste during that time. And then as we learned more about climate change and climate impacts, both internationally and then later making the connection to security, I think the environmental security era sort of broadened and gave way to what I now call the climate security era, which really Josh's scholarship was at the forefront of, and my work with the CNA Military Advisory Board helped put that on the map, particularly with the generals and admirals who were, we together founded the CNA Military Advisory Board and characterized it as a threat multiplier. And that framework helped galvanize, I think, a generation of security professionals to begin to think about it in a security context. And that we see that fully reflected in the work, I'd say, of the current administration, which has adopted that work as reflected in a lot of bipartisan legislation that's been passed over the years and other reports and documents, and then translated into a massive set of executive orders and now directions from the administration. And to Josh's point about, you know, how the understanding of the security impacts of climate change and really of environmental security have broadened and become more, it's not only about directly leading to armed conflict, although we do say sometimes climate change can act as a catalyst for conflict, but there's other dimensions of it, the civil unrest, the, as Josh would say in his book, negative security outcomes. And those can take a wide variety of forms, food, you know, food and water insecurity, or increased demand for humanitarian assistance and disaster response by other governments. So I think those, it's given us a broader set of ways to think about the climate, the nexus of climate insecurity, and enabled us to think, to provide more and better tools for policymakers to integrate this into their work. So I'm, you know, having started in this field really myself as a policymaker and trying to be informed by the scholarship, and now having spent many years affiliated with think tanks in this and working on my own book now on the history of this field. So I am interested, Josh, in particular, how, you know, your stint now at the Department of Defense, how have you found that you could better advise your government colleagues based on your scholarship, one side, and the other side of the question is, where do you, how does this, your stint in DOD, change how you will teach your students in the future based on your bureaucratic, your policymaking experience?
So I think, you know, having an appreciation of the literature and, you know, what people know about the connections between climate and security can help think about what are the levers that governments have some, you know, ability to shape. So, for example, in my book, I talk about how state capacity and political inclusion are really important parameters. You know, whether or not states have the capability to deliver services is an important piece of whether or not governments are able to deliver services in the lead up to exposure to climate threats and are able to respond in their wake. And political inclusion matters in terms of which kinds of groups in society are favored and helped in the wake of hazard exposure. And in inclusive political societies, you know, those that try to include all social groups in representation in government, then you typically end up with more just outcomes. And, you know, for policy, that means, you know, if we see that, you know, there are governments that have weak capacity to deliver services, there's an opportunity to help build up capacity in discrete ways. And we've seen some very good success with that for particular climate hazards. For example, Ethiopia over the past 20 to 30 years is able to build up food security, you know, capacities to ensure that if there was a drought, there were emergency services that were ready to prevent large scale famine. Now, obviously, events in Ethiopia of late have been very distressing and may have undone a lot of that good work. But you do see that states can build up their capacity to address these climate hazards, and international assistance can be mobilized to support those governments in building up that capacity to deliver services if they're so inclined. We've seen similar success in Bangladesh with respect to cyclones, and international assistance was critical in helping the government of Bangladesh build up their capacity to both do early warning for severe cyclones, but also to have cyclone shelters in place. So in the event of a severe cyclone, people were able to get out of harm's way. And international assistance was critical to that. And so I think the sort of sensibilities brought by the academic literature can then help us think about, are there other areas where capacity can be improved in relation to discrete climate hazards? And that's the kind of investments and adaptation that I think, the scholarship, me being able to bring that to bear can start to think, okay, what are the other things that we would like to help and support through policy?
One of the wicked problems often in American security funding, or what we call resourcing, is the historical underfunding of development assistance in the United States compared to other forms of what might be called security or stabilization assistance. So do you think, based on the positive outcomes you were able to document both in Ethiopia and Bangladesh, you could, policymakers could more clearly see the benefits of either USAID or, let's say, State Department conflict stabilization type of assistance to support in other places? Amanda mentioned, Central America, Latin America, that we've been working on, places that suffer from a variety of the issues and problems that you've documented in your other case studies, and sometimes more. Because that's one of the toughest nuts to crack, is how to get policy, at least American policymakers, better to invest in, or legislators to invest more in some of this development assistance that could produce longer term positive security outcomes.
Yeah, I think it should inform those conversations. And I think the argument that I had coming into writing this book and informed and reaffirmed by the experience I've had is that most of the instruments to deal with the climate security impacts are ultimately, the first line of defense are going to be civilian instruments and levers. It's going to be firstly the governments that are affected in those countries, their job to respond to those problems, but backstopped by international assistance. And that international assistance, first and foremost, is going to be development and diplomatic resources. There's a role for militaries to play. But if it becomes the military's problem, a lot of other policy failures have ensued. Now, there is a critical role, I think, for militaries to play in military to military cooperation for like disaster risk reduction, for example. That's an area where militaries can play a critical role and help, like our own military plays a backstopping role to FEMA here in the U.S. to support civilian authorities when called upon and asked, or backstops USAID when called upon internationally. That's true in other societies, and perhaps even more true where some of the civilian capacities are even more limited, and where militaries are really needed to respond to extreme weather events and other climate-related emergencies. So this is kind of a long-winded way of saying, yes, we need to invest more fully in other instruments of national power to ensure that it doesn't become the responsibility of the military to do this work, even though, again, militaries have a critical role to play.
Well, let's go to the second part of my question, Josh, is how has your experience in DOD changed how you will both teach and conjecture research in the future?
So I think in terms of teaching, I talked about the need for students to have an appreciation for what are the levers and tools of that governments are able to influence. I think I'll at least have a little bit of appreciation for how to influence those or inform those conversations, because I've seen it myself and can speak to that with a little bit more granularity. The other aspect of it, I think, is trying to convey that they, I don't have exactly a well-developed sense of how to do this yet, but I want to give people the sense that these things are not easy problems, but also not to despair. And I say that this climate space, there's been news in the last days and such that it's a hard space to work in and sustain one's optimism about the future, but we have to work in and continue to have a sense of duty and obligation, even if the problems are hard. And I'm struck by how to try to communicate that to students who might want to retreat into their private lives and not get involved in public service because it seems too hard, that it seems to be too nasty and too difficult. And then the climate space in particular is it's an uphill battle. And I don't want people to give up on the aspirations for public service and being able to perform better and rise to the moment, even if it looks challenging right now. And that's, trying to figure out how to communicate that is something that I've got to work through in coming weeks and months.
Well, I think that's a good point, Josh. And I'm one who has always felt the call of public service and, been a student of it and practiced it for much of my career. And I often feel when I reflect on it now that you have to have a sense of the time frame and the persistence that can lead to a positive payoff. Mm-hmm. Because, as we sometimes said, the days are long, but the years are short. When you look back, on, let's say, that's what parents often say about, as their children grow up. So, but I look back also on my years, in public service, and I think that I had a lot of days in the Department of Defense where I just felt like I was beating my head against a brick wall to try to make a change. But then if I look back at the totality of, let's say, what we accomplished in the 8 years when I served as a Deputy Undersecretary of Defense for Environmental Security, I feel like we really moved the needle for the department in that era from being seen as an environmental laggard to an environmental leader. And I can document all the ways and the metrics and the directives and the changes quantitatively that were accomplished. But did every little moment feel successful? Or were there some eras that were more, some months that were more challenging than others? Of course. And so kind of staying in it for the longer and having a sense of where that mission is taking you, what outcomes you want to achieve. And then also, I think surrounding yourself and being able to work with people who also have that shared vision and sense of purpose, which I think is what ultimately is often so rewarding about public service. Public service also informed by the good scholarship that you do, which and others do, which is a sense that positive change is possible, even sometimes when we do hit some lows, and those we hit those sometimes, but that change can occur, and that we have to be in it together as a collective.
That's a really hopeful and good message hearing from both of you as just kind of still in the newer parts of the field and entering my professional career. So it's really a good reminder that it's a long game. Even if like there is a bit of despair every now and then, it's a hard field sometimes, but it's good to know. And there's amazing people like both of you that are leading the way and setting foundation so that people like me can kind of navigate a good way in the field. So thank you both. Well, I mean, the only other question I have for you, Josh, is what comes next and where to go from here?
Well, I've been struck by the ways in which some of our plans in this space have been on some level upended or at least challenged by the war in Ukraine and the intense conversations about the clean energy transitions that have ensued given Europe's dependence on Russian gas. And so we're in a moment in which the exigencies of needing access to energy are compelling, but our long run existential challenge of climate change won't go away. So how do we manage that clean energy transition that has to happen, that is unfolding? We see it in the electricity space with renewables. We see it emerging with electric vehicles. It's happening. It's going to be chaotic and pose its own security challenges. It's going to have some steps backward that will make it more difficult to deal with climate change. How do we manage that process? And so trying to think through, is there a role for scholarship to inform and understand that? I'm trying to fashion a new project around that. Mm-hmm. And so that's really what I'm hoping to do in the next project going forward.
Well, we have you're very familiar with our Backdraft series, looking at those unintended consequences of the energy transition and the conflict potentials that might come from it. So as you continue on with your research, I know we'll have many more opportunities to share and hopefully spotlight it as part of that series as well.
Absolutely. Well, thanks so much for having me on and talking about this project, and I look forward to coming on. Hopefully it won't take 7 or 8 years for me to finish the next book.
No.
But I look forward to coming back and talking about some of that next work as well.
Yeah, we're really looking forward to having you and discussing it. So thanks so much, both of you. It's been great to speak with you today and hear all of your insights, your experiences. So thank you.
You've been listening to the New Security Broadcast from the Wilson Center. Thanks for tuning in. For more information, follow us on Twitter @NewSecurityBeat and visit newsecuritybeat.org.